The Old Testament, the book of Ezra, chapter 7. We ended Ezra chapter 6 last Sunday evening on the completion and dedication of the rebuilt temple and the celebration of the first Passover since the Jews' return from Babylon. It was a remarkable occasion, because as we said then, although the Jews were but a tiny remnant of the former great nation, they were now as they had never been before. They were now a purified people, purified of an idolatry they had known and tampered with more or less since Egypt, and which eventually had been their ruin. So that you see the significance of this event and all that it implied in the purification of the Jews, even to Orthodox Jews today with regard to idolatry. The significance of this for Jewry simply cannot be exaggerated. And it's astonishing how little is made of this amongst scholars and teachers and preachers. But now, as we move into chapter 7, we take a leap of something like 60 years. And if you look back to chapter 4, you will see that from the date of 536 B.C., when the Jews returned to Jerusalem, you find that in chapter 4, the first 5 verses, we move forward 16 years beyond the hindrance of the Samaritans, who were hindering the rebuilding of the temple, to the end of that cessation and the rise of the prophets Haggai and Zechariah and the grace of the king emperor Darius, as described in the first half of chapter 6, with the completion of the rebuilding in 516 B.C., after which we move forward another 30 years to 486 B.C. and the time of Esther and Xerxes. Not Artaxerxes, but Xerxes, called in the authorized version Ahasuerus. The time of Esther and Xerxes. That belongs to one verse in chapter 4, the 6th verse only. Then, after these 30 years, another 7 years forward, to the long reign of Artaxerxes himself, the long-handed, who reigned more than 40 years, who first sent Ezra, the scribe and scholar of the law, back to Jerusalem to reestablish the worship of the temple on a sound Jewish basis. We therefore have, in a sweep of history embracing around 100 years, and despite all that the mongrel Samaritans could do to influence the regional governors of Trans-Euphrates, and to influence the several king emperors against the Jews, I say we therefore have, in a sweep of history, embracing around 100 years, 3 of these emperors, Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes. And the astonishing thing about these 3 is this: They couldn't do enough to facilitate the Jews' return to reestablish themselves in their own homeland. Every one of them. Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes. But Artaxerxes' reign, the last of the three, from the Jews' point of view, is not as simple as that of the other two. Because there are three incidents in the career of this Artaxerxes, who is the subject of our chapter tonight. Three incidents in his career pertaining to the Jews. Two are beneficent and gracious and kindly and generous, with one adverse sandwiched between the other two. First, as in our chapter here, Artaxerxes is sending Ezra back to Jerusalem, replete with all he needed to reestablish Jewish life and worship properly in the capital city. Then second, what we read in that major parenthesis that we found in chapter 4, from verse 7 to 23, concerning a letter sent by the enemies of the Jews to Artaxerxes, which procured from him not only the cessation of the building of the city wall. Oh, look at that to confirm it. Chapter 4, verses 21 to 23. 4:21. Now issue an order to these men to stop work, so that this city will not be rebuilt until I so order. Be careful not to neglect this matter. Why let this threat, the threat of the Jews, grow? That's after he'd sent Ezra back, to the detriment of the royal interests. As soon as the copy of the letter of King Artaxerxes was read to Rehum and Shimshai, the secretary, and their associates, they went immediately to the Jews in Jerusalem and compelled them by force to stop. You see. But not only so, but according to Nehemiah chapter 1 and verses 3 and 4, at that time, not only was the work stopped, but the wall was broken down and the city gates burned with fire. That's what distressed Nehemiah. That's the adverse incident of the three. Then comes the third one, by the same man. Nehemiah dared to show his distress before King Artaxerxes when he heard about what had happened to the walls and the gates of Jerusalem. And he showed his distress to the extent that the king kindly inquired of his cupbearer what was wrong with him. And Nehemiah told him his complaint, and dare to ask if he could go to Jerusalem and see what could be done to rebuild the wall. We have, therefore, with regard to this King Artaxerxes, this threefold complex of actions, which would be comic if they were not so serious. These three, that first Artaxerxes sent Ezra back to Jerusalem with blessings, And second, within a few years, there being only 12 to 13 years between Ezra and Nehemiah, on receiving a complaint about the Jews from their enemies, the same king sent them word to cease rebuilding the wall despite all that he had done for Ezra. And then third, within another year or two, he was sending Nehemiah back to view the demolition and to supervise the rebuilding of the wall again. So much so that we are inclined to say to Artaxerxes, "You should make up your mind, man. Are you for the Jews or are you against them? Make up your mind." But of course, executive king emperors, like executive prime ministers, are dependent very often upon their advisors. They cannot know everything about a realm, and they are sometimes advised badly, which may be seen in our land as well as in theirs. For the Jews, you see, these three experiences, good, bad, and good again, was like being on a seesaw, watching the whims of a king emperor. One moment the Jews are in the ascendant, the next down with a bump, and their enemies rejoicing over their discomfiture. And then, with Nehemiah, they're up again. See John Major and his opponents over the poll tax. But then, there's the Lord, as well as the king, and Ezra and Nehemiah. There's the Lord. Ah, yes, there's the Lord. In Britain, too. Especially if his followers pray. But you could hardly call the God of Israel a manipulator, could you? For the pawns, as well as the kings and queens on the chessboard, are all his anyway. And he must win. It's his game. And his chessboard. And his pieces. And he is on both sides. How could that be? Well, he's doing his own thing in respect of his people, but he's also allowing his opponents their legitimate say. Our democratic system with its opposition is an example of this very thing. Their legitimacy with perfect free will and perverse and diabolical though they may be, they cannot, whatever they say and whatever they do, they cannot but help this fact. Whether they know it or not, they mostly don't, but they cannot but help this fact that God is bound in the end to have his own way, however many convolutions of his enemies he permits because of man's free will, which he will never violate. So the Lord does something. The kind of thing he did when, well, at various times, by means of what are called angels, You remember, the Lord put it into the mind of Joseph, Mary's husband, to act to protect the Christ child. Several times angels guided Joseph. So the Lord sent someone from Jerusalem with news to Nehemiah of the destruction of the walls of Jerusalem by the Jews' enemies. And Nehemiah did something about that. He appeared before the king with a face as long as the long hand of Artaxerxes. And that was something to do before a king who chopped off people's heads at the slightest provocation. There must have been a wonderful rapport between these two men, menial though the one was, and the other the monarch of all he surveyed, for the king to notice the change in the other fellow's countenance. One wonders if Nehemiah was as good an actor as King David. You remember? King David, when cornered by King Achish of Gath, behaved like a madman to escape the hand of the Philistine king. Now, I'm not suggesting there was anything calculated about Nehemiah's fallen countenance, but the first chapter of Nehemiah seems to suggest that he could have hid his chagrin, his dismay at the ill news that came from Jerusalem. If he had feared, he might have had his head on the block, which he might have had for failing to smile when he handed the king his unpoisoned liquor. For you see, the king, watching the man's fallen face, might have feared that his wine had been added to, doctored, in fear of which. What did that sad face import? But then, it's Ezra we're on about tonight, not Nehemiah. Nehemiah does keep cropping up, doesn't he? And his exciting book. But it's Ezra the priest tonight. And there's no doubt about his genealogy in verses 1 to 5. Although, as Derek Kidner says, and I observed during the reading, there are several generations omitted, as could be discovered by the inquisitive by looking up to two places, at least 2 Kings 25 and 18, and 1 Chronicles 6 and 15, where you'll find other generations of his genealogy. Indeed, Derek Kidner suggests that it was Ezra, more than any other Jew in Babylon, who was responsible for the emphasis on the Old Testament scrolls, and studying and poring over the Old Testament scrolls while the Jews were there in Babylon. And as I suggested during the reading, that could mean that Ezra was possibly the founder or the co-founder of the synagogues. And you know, all that we read of him subsequently could confirm that notion, or something like it. We'll see in weeks to come, God willing. And that's a wonderful thought, isn't it? That he would have been mainly responsible for encouraging the Jews to pore over God's word the way they never did in Jerusalem and Judea, and to start the synagogues, which are the precursor, if you like, of Protestant and Presbyterian church worship. Our service is run very much in the lines of the old synagogues, allowing for differences, of course. Ezra was, of course, a teacher well versed in the law of Moses, which the Lord had given Moses at Sinai. But also, and this is very important and is emphasized several times in the chapter, the hand of the Lord his God was upon him. And that caused the king emperors to be free-willingly inclined to grant whatever Ezra asked. God was behind that, moving the king. And when the hand of the Lord is on you, you sure ask. Yes, you do. You are aware. You are aware, if I can use modern terminology, you are aware that the ball is in your court. And if you play it as the Lord would have you, the game is yours. And so he chose, did Ezra, those of his race who were nearest to him and to his intentions and his ambitions and desires for the Jews in Jerusalem, priests and Levites, accustomed back in Jerusalem as they had been to several duties, like singers and gatekeepers, etc. He chose them to go with him. It was a long journey, about 900 miles, and took them 5 months. But again, the good hand of the Lord was upon the journey, journeying mercies, as we so often glibly say, an important point in the life of Christians moving around the country. Island. Do you remember the busload of medics, doctors, and their families from the Manorom Hospital in central Thailand that crashed and killed them all? No journeying mercies there. Robin Taylor has worked in Dunedin, New Zealand, with a doctor whose wife and whole family were wiped out in that crash in Thailand. And he has told me of its effects on that dear man. But beyond the journey, the important thing was that Ezra, who was the head of that expedition, was thoroughly prepared for his ultimate task. For he had devoted himself to the study and observance of the law of the Lord and to teaching its decrees and laws in Israel. He had engaged in his own divinity studies and was more than prepared to be the leader he became in Jerusalem. And Ezra had a letter with him, of which, notice again, the writer of this history says, he had a copy. Keep copies of important writings. That's what we're busy looking at now. Tom Swanston's valuable writings. The letter is addressed to Ezra personally from the king. Some of the scholars suggest that he had written it and presented it to the king. With due acknowledgement of his quality and qualifications. And as you would have seen from our reading, the letter is just so generous. As indeed, we must confess this, as indeed are all these permissions from these three king emperors, Cyrus to Zerubbabel, Darius to Zerubbabel, upon the Lord moving the prophets Haggai and Zechariah to act, and now Artaxerxes to Ezra, and then later Artaxerxes to Nehemiah, the generosity of all these men. Ezra is to take to Jerusalem who he likes, and as much gold and silver as he needs to buy animals and appurtenances for the ritual sacrifices. If there is more money that you need for these services, says the letter, do what you like with the rest in accordance with the will of God. If there's need for extras, then appeal to the royal treasury. And so the letter sets out the amounts to be given to Ezra. And it is important, says this superstitious pagan, it is important that the God of heaven should not be angry with me or my sons, so that we land in trouble. Now, on that superstitious level, we can, of course, smile at the pagan king's religious views. But when you live in materialistic Britain, which is largely, virtually atheistic in its way of life, God doesn't come into the thinking of its people at all. One looks round amongst one's neighbors. It's appalling. God doesn't come into their thinking at all. Nor into the thinking, as far as we can judge by their words and actions, of most of the rulers of this realm, the Queen herself being the notable exception. Well, do you think that God comes into the thoughts of John Major and Michael Heseltine very much, as they wrestle with possible forms of taxation? And if they do not, can you think of a needier case for the wisdom of God than that? In times of war, there is sometimes a call for prayer, a national call for prayer, although the leaders of the churches are slow even to say it. Don't you think there is a call for prayer about the poll tax? Yet I haven't heard a prayer in our prayer meeting about that that I can recall. The last paragraph of the king's letter gives Ezra liberty to govern and command. This is astonishing, quite astonishing. The last paragraph gives Ezra liberty to govern and command the life of all the Jews trans-Euphrates. That's absolutely astonishing. He is practically to institute a teaching mission in the land, the sort of thing which believe it or not, Billy Graham, the sort of thing which had been done in the whole history of the Israelite monarchy only once that I read of. I read of only one teaching mission in the whole history of Israel. I'll read to you about it. And you can look it up for yourself, 2 Chronicles 17 and 3. This is singular. 2 Chronicles 17 and 3. The Lord was with Jehoshaphat because in his early years he walked in the ways that his father David had followed. He did not consult the Baals, but sought the God of his father and followed his commands rather than the practices of Israel. See how far astray they had gone. The Lord established the kingdom under Jehoshaphat's control, and all Judah brought gifts to the king so that he had great wealth and honor. His heart was devoted to the ways of the Lord. Furthermore, he removed the high places and the Asherah poles from Judah. Now, in the third year of his reign, he sent his officials, Ben-Hail, Obadiah, Zechariah, Nethanel, and Micaiah, to teach in the towns of Judah. Teach in the towns of Judah. How interesting. I was listening to our brother Sinclair Ferguson amongst the trustees of Rutherford House discussing what they would do as far as the future of that theological study center in Edinburgh was concerned, because the ministers of Scotland have not made use of it and have not made use of that precious library there, most of which came from Gordon Anderson Smith's library. And he said, if the ministers are too busy and too taken up with their families to come there to study, we'll need to go to them and have weekend courses in Stornoway and Inverness and Aberdeen. This is exactly what we read here. To teach in the towns of Judah. With them were certain Levites, with all these names that I'm not going to read, and the priests, the Levites, and the two priests. They taught throughout Judah, taking with them the book of the law of the Lord. They went round to all the towns of Judah and taught the people. Now notice the result of that. The fear of the Lord fell on all the kingdoms of the lands surrounding Judah, so that they did not make war with Jehoshaphat. That's the way to make peace. Get the people to study God's word. Some Philistines brought Jehoshaphat gifts and silver as tribute, and the Arabs brought him flocks, 7,700 rams and 7,700 goats. Ah, but Jehoshaphat became more and more powerful. He built forts and store cities in Judah. God prospered him, you see, which is the most dangerous thing that can happen to any Christian. And had large supplies in the towns of Judah. He also kept experienced fighting men in Jerusalem. And that prosperity was his downfall. But you see the teaching missions? And that's what Ezra was sent to Jerusalem to do. And you see, Artaxerxes' letter virtually gave to Ezra power of life and death over Jews wherever they were to be found in Trans-Euphrates, west of the Euphrates. It was a tremendous decree, wasn't it? Nor is Ezra himself unaware of the amazing permissions that God had given him. But of course, there's no fear There's no fear, as in the sad case of good King Jehoshaphat, that such power and authority would go to Ezra's head. See his private thoughts about that. It was because he saw himself, and you see this in the last paragraph of the chapter, his comments on the letter. It was because he saw himself as the agent of God and of God's goodness to his people, that with his mouth and heart full of praise to his generous God, he set about preparing for the long journey and the work that lay ahead of him when he got there. Not only did he choose those who would go with him in quite a caravan, but they are all documented with their numbers. As we may see later on, something like 1,500 men. Quite a transportation, wasn't it? Wonderful. So what are we going to make of all this? What are we to take out of all this? Simply this, I think, that when the purposes of God for his people are at stake, and they, or some of them, are in a state of submission to God's holy will, and also in a condition of knowledge of his word, his law, and his ways, then the Lord can move heaven and earth to further their purposes. Wonderful, wonderful. After our Deacon's Court meeting on Tuesday, at which we were shown the meticulousness of all the plans that are being made for the rebuilding of our spire and the refurbishing of our buildings, with drawings so excellent that some of them are to be lent to an art exhibition in Edinburgh. Plans which are to cost, they now tell us, in the region of 1,000,000¾. And when the need for a replacement for our esteemed free will offering treasurer John Lawton was made known, who hopes to return to his beloved Orkney to live out his days there, almost immediately there came to our minds in the Deacon's Court, and it had occurred to one or two before that, our brother Alistair Smith, the accountant, who, when approached with alacrity, said he was ready to undertake the work. Almost before you ask, the Lord gives. And as we drove home from that Deacon's Court meeting on Tuesday, James, our church officer, said to me on entering the car, "The Lord always provides." Of course, when we're in his will, there's nothing he will not do and nothing he will not give us in the interests of his cause. Nor can I think of a case, for you know, we hear of many of our ministers who have difficulty in filling important posts in their congregations, in which, nor can I think of a case in which we are supplied with so many willing and equipped helpers in every department of the church's work. What a privileged people we are. And how we, like Ezra, should acknowledge the hand of God upon us for good, and therefore see to it that we neither abuse such high privilege or take it lightly or for granted.
God.
Our hearts should be so cordially disposed to the Lord and to each other that His blessings may continue, and that we might be less and less unworthy of His many, many blessings. Therefore, this Easter evening, I end with these words. Pray.